Thanks for not only having me, but for coming out to this. I'm sure there's probably, you know, a lot of other things going on a Friday night in Seattle. Yeah, keep in mind that I come from a town of maybe 300. You know, I found that I was out in the airport, a little far south, I better turn around. it's a little bewildering and exciting at the same time to be in the big city. So, my name is Brian Berkey. I started brewing in end of 1992, 93 at Bridgeport, completely by a fluke. I got out of marketing and research and decided I needed to do something with my hands. Had a roommate at the time that was brewing down at Bridgeport, so he recommended that I go down and try to get a job on the packaging line. So I shined my shoes, put on my blue linen, white collared shirt, put the tie on, walked into the brewery, and introduced myself to the packaging manager, told him I was here for the open position. He looked up at me and said, "You're not right for the job." What do you mean, man? You can't do that to me. You at least got to give me a chance. So he kind of hung his head, and gave a big sigh, and said, "Okay, you come back tomorrow morning, 8 a.m. I'll pay you $5 an hour under the table for the first day. If you like it, we'll fill out the paperwork. If you don't, I'll buy you a beer, pay you cash, and send you out the door." And so that was my introduction to craft brewing. Before that, my dad and my uncles were all moonshiners. So they would get together once a week and run distill out in the barn. I think it was more as an opportunity to get away from the wives and do something as, you know, brothers than it was really anything else. But, you know, when the packaging guy took me through the tour of the brewery, it's like, all right, I know this. I don't understand what's going on here, but this is all familiar to me, so it makes sense. And fortunately, there was a lot of slackers that were working at the brewery at the time. So you show a little bit of interest and some initiative, and next thing you know, you're doing filtration, you're working in the cellar. All right, now you're subbing for brewing. Now you're on brew deck. And then after the 5 years, I was the not the head brewer, but the lead brewer on staff. During the time I was there, it transitioned from being owned by a winery company called Ponzi's, and an outfit out of Texas called Gambrinus picked it up, and that's when I was honored to get back on it. And it was great experience and education, not only working from the old establishment, but also Carl. He brought in a fellow by the name of Phil Sexton, the whole Matilda Bay Brewing out of Australia, and now he runs a brewery down there, or a winery down there called Little Creatures, and he's back in the brewing game as well. So to be able to pick up some skills from that guy, Bridgeport IPA, Phil Sexton, that's his recipe. And so being there when that first came out and watching how all that went down, it was, that's school that you can't buy, you know. But after 5 years of living in Portland, it was offered a job out at Full Sail Brewing out in Hood River. And so I went out there and brewed with those guys for a couple of years, got off of brew deck and got into operations. And that's basically the interface where the brewery kind of meets the sales team in terms of, you know, what is the marketplace asking for, and that kind of dictates what you do on a commercial level, and in terms of not only beer styles but also tweaking existing recipes, that sort of thing. After operations, I did some off-premise sales in the Portland area for a little while. Side sales is not my deal. I need to get back into brewing. And then I went down to the Gordon Biersch Group down in San Jose, where I was the head brewer at the brew pub in San Jose for a few years. And then went to the production plant, worked for Dan Gordon for a couple of years. And I was ready to get out of California the day I got down there, so it just took me a little while to find a good job back in the Northwest. Fortunately, a position came open out at Y East Labs. A couple of the microbiologists that worked there I brewed with at Full Sail, and so they kind of got me dialed into the customer service manager position, which is what I'm holding right now. So that's kind of my background. I've only been with the lab for about a year and a half or so. I'm not a microbiologist, but I know a lot of the basics, and I've got a decent brewing resume behind me. So I know that the Waha as an entity is relatively young. We had Dick from Elysian and Ralph here to do a talk, so it's nice to kind of follow in their footsteps. But as I kind of go through my rambling about yeast tonight, I'm going to cover a lot of ground, but I'm not going to get too deep in any one area. So keep in mind that that we're up here, Y Yeast as a company, once a year for the Cask Beer Festival. It's going on tomorrow. We're sponsors. So if there's an area that you want to really get intensive into, just let us know. And next year, maybe have one of Greg, one of our microbiologists, come up and can talk with you guys about the many facets that are involved in fermentation, and you can get really, really intensive. Probably more information that you really want to know. So. But we're here to cover some basics on yeast, some fundamentals, and so I'm a good person to do the primer. So, what is yeast? It's a single-celled organism. It's a fungus. It's a form of mold. It reproduces by budding, as opposed to osmosis. It kicks off daughter cells from a mother. It's all under the genus of Saccharomyces, and then it splits into two families. One is Cerevisiae, or ale yeast, and then there's lager yeast, once known as Uvarum, and now it's known as Carlsberg Guinness, and then that's changed again to Pastorini or
Pastorius.
Thank you very much. Who knows what it might turn into here in a few years. But all brewing yeast kind of falls into those two camps, and then we'll talk about some of the not rejects, but kind of the one-offs a little bit later. And yeast is everywhere. I mean, yeast is atmospheric. It's on every surface you see. There's not a sugar or a carb source out there that I don't think that has, some form of yeast that exists that will consume it. So historically speaking, we've unknowingly relied upon yeast to do a lot of functions when it comes to making our bread or beer or wine or really any other fermentation process like sauerkraut or pickling, those sort of functions. It's been with us a really long time, but we haven't really known what yeast is or what it does until since the mid 1800s. And by and large, it's recognized that it was Pasteur that really kind of brought it to the forefront. But actually, this Dutchman back in 1680 or so, and his name, Antoine van Leeuwenhoek. And I should know that because I'm a big Ren and Stimpy fan, and Ren Hoek's name is right there. But he was an amateur lens maker, and he was the first one that actually wrote about yeast in these homemade microscopes that he was making. Had no idea what he was looking at, but he was the first one to actually kind of put it on paper that described yeast. So it's not the 1850s, you know, but actually it goes back a little bit earlier than that. Where it's like, hey, we've got this bug around that's doing some wonderful things for us. So because it's relatively new, we're still kind of learning what it does. I mean, we've known for a long time, in terms of flavor, what the different ingredients kind of bring to the table. You know, grain, hops, herbs, historically speaking. So yeast is really, it's kind of exciting that, you know, this is our big kind of opportunity for tweaking beers, getting flavor components from yeast, and we're still trying to figure out how to do that. And there's a lot of way to get different flavors into your beer, not only by strain selection, but also how do you manipulate the yeast that you do choose to put into your beers. And and I think that there's a lot of misunderstanding when it comes to the manipulation of yeast in your brewing, but that also provides you a lot of opportunity. So we'll talk a little bit about that when we get into aeration and pitch rates and strain selection. So what does yeast do? Well, like many of us, yeast really all it wants to do is reproduce. That's it. It doesn't care what beer you're making. It doesn't care if you've got a 5-gallon plastic bucket or a cool conical. It doesn't care if you're a Nicasi Award winner or if you're just fresh out of the gates doing extract brews. Really, all it wants to do is breed. Dr. Lewis from University of California, Davis, has got like my favorite quote going right now, and it's that brewers make wort and beer makes yeast. And really, if you think about it, that's true. You know, the only thing that we do is we give these critters the tools they need to breed. And how we make good beer, hopefully, and be able to reproduce the good beer, hopefully, that we're making, is to control the extent and the rate that yeast reproduces. So, and if we can maintain that consistency, then we're able to consistently repeat the beer that we're producing. So it's something to keep in mind. Again, I'm gonna repeat that. It's the extent and the rate that we control that reproduction in yeast. And if you can control the fermentation that you're doing, then you're able to consistently reproduce it, but also be able to manipulate it, you know, one way or another to determine what your final product turns out to be. So, how do we do that? One is we pitch correctly, meaning how much yeast that we put into our wort and the strain that we put into the wort, the correct nutrition, how we make that wort. You know, are we doing the same thing time and time again, meaning you know what sort of you know, attenuation or a conversion that you're getting out of your mash, what sort of evaporation rate you're getting out of your boil, are you using a nutrient or not, and then controlling the environmental conditions, or basically your fermentation, primarily temperature. That has a lot to do with how fast your yeast will grow, and that rate of growth will determine a lot of the flavors that you get out of your beer. If anybody has questions, don't be nervous about interrupting me. I'm going to get into Q&A here at the end of the talk as well. Don't have a problem about throwing up your hand. I'll promise not to try to ramble on as long as Ralph did at your last talk, because he went like an hour and a half or so. So I know that there's some beers being consumed and restroom calls and that sort of thing. So holler. So yeast, when we pitch our yeast into our wort, what does it do once it gets in there? Well, all yeast kind of goes through three different steps or stages, depending on how much you put in and what strain you're using. There's going to be some variables to these, but by and large, all yeast goes through three phases. And that's a lag phase, a log phase, and a stationary phase. And regardless of your ferment, your yeast is going to encounter these three steps. So we've taken our vial or activated our smack pack, or we've made our starter, and we pitch into our 5, 10, 15, 50 gallon batch of beer, whatever it is that we're making at the time, and nothing happens. What the hell's going on? And nothing strikes fear in the heart of brewers like having a batch of wort sitting there with no visible activity. Well, unless that yeast is flat out dead, or the cell count is so low that it's having a hard time getting going, fear not. There is action going on, and that lag phase is when the yeast is kind of getting used to its environment, getting used to the neighborhood, introducing itself to the neighbors, that sort of thing. What it's doing is it's taking energy that it's stored since its last ferment or metabolic cycle, and it's kind of waking itself up, getting rolling. It's taking the oxygen that you've put in, hopefully, you've put into your wort, and it's using that oxygen to create some sterols, and more importantly, folic acid, to limber up or warm up the cellular wall, so that it can become flexible enough to kick out those daughter cells, and also so that it can pass sugar across the cell membrane to create the CO2, the alcohol, and other metabolic wastes that we know and love, esters, phenols, that sort of thing. Now, this kind of touches on the whole notion of using olive oil. And I want to ask you guys, has anybody tried that yet?
That was one of my questions.
Okay, cool. So what olive oil does, and I don't know if anybody of you have heard about it or read about it as of yet, but there's a lot of talk on the boards and even in the pro community of using olive oil instead of oxygen to provide the yeast cells that source of folic acid. And it works great. You get a violent, rampant fermentations. There's plenty of folic acid in a minute amount of olive oil. We're talking the, just enough on the end of like a toothpick or a needle in a 5-gallon batch is more than you need. We're talking a tiny, tiny amount. The folks down at New Belgium actually did a big test with this and had this big write-up in the MBAA, Master Brewers Association of America, and they put out quarterly tech journals of the study that they did. And great fermentation cycles, flavor profiles, everything, with the exception of long-term stability. They found, and you would think that this would be the other way around, since you're putting oxygen into your wort, that really the O2 can be a degrading factor to your finished product, but actually the flavor really started to tweak in beers that were given that olive oil addition for its folic acid source after about 6 weeks or so. And so they opted not to do that. Obviously, they're shipping beer. I mean, you know, here and yon, they need product to have a long-term shelf life. But if you've got beer that you're, you know, a pale ale that you're going to brew up and keg off in, you know, 2 to 3 weeks, and you know that keg is going to be gone in a day or or even not that much longer, you know, olive oil, I think, is a great great tool, you know, to have in your box. Yeah.
So is there any sort of procedure you need to practice with the olive oil and deem sanitary?
No. The you know, and we haven't monkeyed around with it at the lab yet, but it's something that we want to do. But what I've read is that you put that in right at the end of your boil before you cool, and that solves that question.
Does it have to be extra virgin, blended?
I mean, totally.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't, oil, yeah.
Honestly, I don't think it matters.
Okay.
But I don't know. I don't know. Yeah.
Does anyone understand why the longevity isn't there with the olive oil?
No. And you know, this whole concept is relatively new. I mean, it's only kind of come on the radar within the past couple of years or so. Nobody's really looked at it. And it would have been these guys at New Belgium, I mean, who have more engineers than they do brewers on staff. And I mean, their lab department is, I mean, surpasses ours. If you go to GABF, take the time to spend a day and go up to New Belgium. They've got one of two Merlin kettles in the country. It's a phenomenal place. And most of the beers aren't that bad either, so it's a big plus. Except for the flat tire, cannot stand that stuff. And that's my personal opinion, but the La Folie is probably one of my top three domestic beers being produced in this country right now. So, and they've got this Dark Creek. I saw a bottle of that. You guys had that? Is it good? All right, so I'll pick up a bottle and take it back to the lab because we don't get a lot of beer out in the Hood River, you know. All right, so back to the yeast cycles here. So that's what's going on in the lag phase, is the yeast is kind of getting warmed up, getting ready to do its job. And if you plot your fermentation out on a curve in terms of activity, you kind of see it kind of slowly kind of take off, peak out, and then kind of taper off. So this is that initial curve is lag phase. Then it goes into log phase, right at the top. And this is where, if you're... Yo!
Yeah. You hear a lot about lag phase. Is a two-hour lag phase better than, say, an eight-hour lag phase?
I don't think it matters. You can have a 30-hour lag phase. It really kind of depends on the health, viability, and vitality of the yeast that you've put in there. So as long as you can get that... acclimated and up and moving, then you're gonna be okay when it comes to the lag phase itself. Now, if you've got an old activator or an old vial, you haven't done a starter, and you know that yeast takes 12 to 24 hours to take off. In terms of what you're going to get out of your final product versus a fresh pitch, you know, that has a two-hour lag, I don't think it matters. You know, when I go to conferences and whatnot, I hate it when company reps get up and they push their product, they hype their product. You know, it's like, I'm not here to listen to your sales pitch. I'm here to listen to some tech info. So I really want to avoid that. But that being said, I think that's where our activator packs really kind of are a big benefit. You know, the big risk in having a long lag phase is that you're allowing the potential for infection to kind of take hold, right? And which can be a serious concern if that yeast doesn't take off. It all comes down to a fight for food. You got all that sugar mess that's in there, and something's going to eat it. You're either going to get your selected and desired yeast or bacterial strain to take hold, or you're going to let some other environmental influence dictate the terms. But if you get that yeast up and moving, yeah, within a 36-hour period, then by and large, you're going to be okay in the end. Now, there's going to be a lot of other factors kind of at the end of your fermentation cycle and in your finished beer. They say, hey, maybe I effed up somewhere early on in the line. But that could be a whole host of things. Either, you know, an unconverted wort, you got low viability yeast, you've got an infected yeast source, either from the company. It doesn't really happen that often, but on occasion it will occur. Or you've brought yeast over from another brew. So, you know, as long as you get fermentation going, you know, is it a 2-hour lag or a 20-hour lag? I don't think it really matters. So, sir.
So, kind of along the same lines, I've had times when the lag seems to be getting into the 24th hour. I start to get a little nervous.
Yeah.
My impulse is to go ahead and try to kickstart it again. Is that a bad impulse, or is it better just to try to wait it out?
How do you aerate?
Shake.
Okay. No. It's not necessary. You know. Again, I don't think you really start getting into kind of a danger zone until you hit the 36-hour mark. And if you're nervous up to that point, don't go by what you're seeing in your airlock or visible activity. Take a hydrometer reading. That's going to give you the first indication as to whether or not anything's going on in there. You could have an atmospheric leak, an improper seal. So even though your airlock isn't showing any activity, you know, you could start to see a drop in your gravity, and that's indicating that your yeast has gone through its lag phase, and now it's starting to get into log phase, which is going to lead into the bulk of your fermentation in terms of its drop in sugar, the consumption of sugar, production of alcohol, CO2, and other metabolic wastes. So, sir.
So does the yeast actually start producing alcohol before it produces CO2?
I think it's simultaneous. There may be a, you know, one might be before the other, but honestly, I don't know. I don't know. Is it simultaneous? Yeah.
The oxygen that's been dissolved in your wort is taken up by the yeast, and so the CO2 that's being produced can also dissolve in your wort. So you might not see any activity in your beer, especially lagers. It can take a long time for the bubbler to get going just because, you know, at a colder temperature, the wort can absorb that much more CO2.
But even during aerobic respiration, you should be getting a little CO2 if you're
using that,
right?
Yeah. I mean, Brian can probably talk to this as well, but during the aerobic phase, the yeast are typically not respiring. They're actually fermenting. The oxygen is used for other things.
Right. Yeah, the production of those sterols, the folic acid, so that it can go through its log phase or the actual fermentation activity. So, and it's this log phase that it's really, this is where the bulk of the activity is going to occur. If you're using 3068 or some other 1214 is another one where it's, you know, blowing out your airlocks or clogging things up, you know, making a big mess on your floor, this is what's causing it, is that that log phase. And the thing that can help control that is temperature. If you are just letting your ferments free rise, you'll see a big spike in your temperature, you know, up to 5 degrees or more Fahrenheit. Excuse me. During the spot, and to maintain consistency on your beer, you need to try to have some element of control during that time when it comes to temperature. So
I got a question.
Yep.
So let's compare two different yeasts in the same wort. So half a batch with 1214 and half a batch with 3787.
Okay.
I've noticed with the 1214 is a slow starter, so it's got a longer lag phase.
Correct.
Than 3787.
Yep.
But 1214 will attenuate down. I mean, it'll take a 1090 wort down to 1009. And I've always had 3787 stall out at...
Speak up a little bit.
Sorry. I've always had 3787 stall out at, you know, maybe 65% attenuation, where 1214 will take it down to 85-90% attenuation. And is it kind of ramping up during that longer lag phase to attenuate more, or are they not related at all?
It's really what you're describing is characteristics or traits of the strains. Some of them will, you know, and they're like all of us here. I mean, we all act, think, you know, operate a little bit differently. So 1214, Belgian Ale, the Chimay yeast, and the 3787, the Trappist High Gravity, which is the Westmalle yeast, you know, they're it's almost like apples and oranges. You know, they're going to act completely different, even though you're working off of a single wort, which is a fun project to do. And if you haven't done it, I really recommend it, because it'll show you the impact that yeast has on what you get out of a final product. You know, just by strain selection, you know, you get it with a completely different beer. But no, that's characteristic more of the strain than any other environmental condition that might be going on. So depending on what strain you're pulling from, definitely impacts that curve, that rate of fermentation, and ultimately, really, all we give a crap about is, you know, what does it taste like, you know, in the end. So
temp control. Really important in controlling how fast a yeast gets through that log phase, and it's also during this peak of fermentation activity that the bulk of the esters, phenols, other metabolic waste are produced. So how we can control what the yeast does during that time controls the byproducts of fermentation. And once it kind of gets through this log phase, now it kind of goes into stationary phase. It's like, all right, I've worked hard enough. There's not a lot of food left. You know, I've produced basically all I feel like at this time. So now it's going to start kind of internalizing a lot of this metabolic activity. Starts building up stores. Some energy reserves, you know, the power bar in its back pocket, so that when it goes into dormancy, which it knows it's coming down the pipe here, that it's got enough juice to get through another lag phase into log phase into stationary phase and so on and so forth. So. And if you're using a strain and you're repitching yeast or saving yeast, you need to keep that in mind that this stationary phase is kind of when it builds up stores, and you know, wort will provide yeast basically all the tools, the nutritional tools that it needs to do the job. But if you look at it long term, and if you're looking to get 8, 10, 12 generations, you know, out of your initial pitch, which is a company, you know, we really don't want you to do. We want you to buy more yeast. But you know, the reality is that if you're going to push yeast to that extent, then you really need to think about using a yeast nutrient to make sure that you're giving it everything it needs to build those nutritional stores. So that can go through repeated and successful fermentation. So,
is there a time period when it goes through that time, that lag period, that it should sit to kind of strengthen up, for lack of a better word?
No. Really, all you're worried about as a brewer is it's going to do it on its own. You just need to make sure that you allow it the time to actually hit its final gravity or fully attenuate before you turn down the temperature and you halt activity. So, you know, let it get to final, give it a day or two, and then you can crash. So
with my starter, for example, right now I made the wrong starter. I pitched an Irish ale instead of a British ale, so I'm going to put it aside.
Okay.
Put it in the fridge.
Yep.
Sink to the bottom, pour it off, and save it. How long can I save it? How long is it going to remain in that dormant stage before it decides, you know what, nobody's going to use us, which is going
to
die?
You're going to start to see reduction in viability after 2 to 3 weeks, but it's going to be strain specific on how fast it starts to autolyze and die off. There are some strains that just do not store well, and 3078 is probably at the top of the bunch. This yeast will just dies off really fast, to where you get almost a 0% viability after storage in 6 to 8 weeks. But you pick a Belgian strain like the 1214 or the 3787, you know, they're a lot more resilient. They'll hold in that kind of storage condition for a longer period of time. You know, depending on how clean that yeast is, you know, what sort of solids might be in it, the temperature that it's held at will also influence on how well it holds up. But if you're planning on saving yeast, then maybe every 3 to 4 months or so, and again, it's all going to be strain specific, but every 3 to 4 months or so, just go ahead and take your slurry that you've got sitting in your fridge and run it through a starter process, and that way you're able to get the increase the cell mass, viable cell mass, to hold up for another kind of storage cycle. So, you know.
Is there any with when you wake it back up again? I've seen everything that says, you know, when you pull it out of the fridge, wake it back up with a little wort before you pitch it. Is there any specific amount? Because my concern is that with putting it in the fridge, what I'm trying to do is decant it, because I'm concerned that a 2-liter or 4-liter starter is affecting my final product.
Yeah.
Any specific amount I want to wake it up with, or do I just pour it in the batch and...
If you're going to store yeast, then absolutely make a starter. Also, keep in mind that every time that you handle yeast, that you make a starter, put it into a storage of a flask or a vessel, that you're opening yourself up for the possibility of infection. And so just... You got to have your ducks in a row when it comes to sanitation, as we all really we know. But it's even more important when it comes to keeping yeast. But you can, anything that I would store, I would go ahead and go through a starter. And in terms of, okay, now that I've got my starter, how much of that do I want to pitch? Do I decant or not? Look at what kind of beer that you're trying to make. If you're making a Kolsch or a light American lager or something that's lighter, milder, delicate, low alcohol, then decant the wort off the top of that yeast bed so you're just pitching yeast. If you're making a Russian Imperial Stout, that beer is going to be able to soak up, you know, basically the entire contents of your starter with no, you know, impact on its flavor. Which is, again, what we really, that's all we care about, you know, is in the end, is what does this beer taste like? And, you know, and yeast ranching is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You know, being able to pull a Pac-Man out of the bottom of a you know, Shakespeare stout, or even some bugs out of the bottom of a Belgian bottle. You know, it's just like, hey, not a lot of guys you know, have access to what I've just got my hands on. And a lot of that stuff make great beer. So, P-Dog, did you have a question?
Yeah, I was going to ask if there was a correlation between clock rates and whether the storability goes up or down, but I started thinking about it. And so for the common strains, like the 1056 or 1968 or the 1098, do those tend to be quick decay, or do they last? Or, you know, what's your...
Now they,
what are your thoughts on that?
They, those ale strains will hold up pretty well. The 1056 being, you know, the front runner in that. I think the 1028 will store well also. The thing that will impact your flocculation more than anything is you know, on a homebrewing level, it's not that big of a concern because you're taking a kind of a homogeneous sample of the slurry that might be at the bottom of your carboy. You got to mix that up before you pour that off. The commercial guys have to be a little more conscious of cones, which tends to stratify in terms of the yeast that's sitting in that cone, where you get some crappy yeast, or maybe the more flocculent yeast wants to get down to that cone. So if you know, if you dump too much yeast and now you've picking up a layer of cells in there that isn't necessarily as flocculent as the original pitch was, and now you've repitched another beer, it's like, why is this stuff not, you know, flocking out? That's usually the case. But if we're just going to store yeast, you know, in a mason jar or whatnot, then usually we've got to mix it up. We've got a nice homogeneous representation of the yeast that might be in that that ferment. So, did you have your hand up earlier?
Yeah. With yeast nutrient, when would you add that?
When?
Yeah.
It's got to go in at the end of your boil. So for beer, if you're making wine, then it goes in directly to your must. So,
I always heard to put it in with your like Irish must. 20 minutes.
Perfect. You know, or 5 minutes before the end of your boil. That's adequate. So
you are clean.
And unless you're doing a pressurized boil, you know, where temperatures are broaching 212, then it's a non-issue. So.
When do you want to use nutrient? I mean, nutrient's relatively cheap.
It is. It's dirt cheap.
When wouldn't you want to use it, though?
You know, if you're just doing a one-off, two-off batch, it's not necessary. You know, but if you're looking to get multi-generations out of your beer, or if your beer is going to be, like, high gravity, then definitely give it some nutrient. But outside of that, not even necessary, so. Yeah.
Well, now, when you're producing that yeast, this, you know, to market,
yeah,
how do you keep it going, you know, batch after batch after batch? How do you save it and then keep it growing, keep it going so you can...
Well, we have a yeast bank of about a little over 300 different strains. You know, what you guys have access to is maybe 40 to 60 of those, and that includes the stuff that we're kicking out with our private collection, or the formerly known as the BSS program. All 300 plus of those strains get recultured annually, and so we'll go back into the slant, or what we've got it, its storage condition, and we'll regenerate that so that we've always got something relatively fresh that we can go back into the well and pull from. Now, what we're looking to do, and we're talking about this, is that there's a there's a method of DNA fingerprinting, so that we can take, like our 1056, and we can run it through this machine, and we can kind of create a fingerprint for it. So that now every year, you know, when we go back and reculture that slant, you know, the stuff that we pull from the slant, we can run back through this machine and say, you know, hey, are we hitting the marks? You know, has this yeast mutated? Have we stressed it out in any way, shape, or form that might cause it to change? Which is a very real threat when you are subjugating a yeast strain to environmental stresses. That's why you don't want to re-pitch yeast that you've done like a high gravity or a high alcohol ferment or something that's got a massive amount of IBUs to it. That can mutate yeast. But sometimes that mutated yeast works out to your benefit. For example, we've got a customer in Hawaii who is on their like 120th generation of some yeast that they don't know because their entire brew staff is turned over. The brewery was sold to a new owner. All he knows is that he's seen this, you know, really high number on their yeast generations. So he sent us a sample and he's like, "Can you tell me what's going on?" Well, there was so much crap in that slurry in terms of bacteria. There's a term for it. It's called a TNTC, and that means too numerous to count. That it took us 3 plating cycles to get that stew kind of isolated enough to where, okay, we can pull a single morphology of or single culture of yeast out of whatever it was that he sent over to us. Now, what that was, you know, when he first got it, we have no idea. But if we had this DNA machine, then we could plug it in. It's like, okay, does this match up with any other fingerprint that we might have in the system, or is it some variant thereof? It might be 1056, but it does better at ester production, whatever the variable might be. But right now we're not quite there yet. There are companies out there, and the dried guys, to give them some credit, they have this technology. But we're about we're about 70 grand away from pulling that thing in and getting it installed. But we go through annually and reculture this stuff, and when you plate it out, you can look at it on a plate, and visually you can identify. It's like, okay, it's you know, this is the 1056 that we know and love, or that morphology is pink. What the hell is going on? You better pull that from the catalog because some sort of mutation has occurred. And there was a strain that happened, and it got pulled from our catalog. I can't remember which one it was, but it happened within the past, since I've been there, for the past year and a half. And you know, why don't you have Thames Valley 2 anymore? It's like, well, it mutated on us, and now it's not Thames Valley 2. We'll send you this pink yeast, you know, if you want it. Yeah.
I guess you're pretty much answering my question more from my head down here. Is, you know, yeast is a live creature, and it's evolving. is far faster than we are.
Yeah.
And so the tastes of the flavors of beer have evolved through the years, and I expect we're tasting better stuff now than we ever have before. But the real question is, with the, say, American ale yeast, 1056, is what we have now going to be the same thing as we have, say, 60 years from now? Is it going to be a different thing in producing different flavors? Or will we be able to, you know, hold on to the same thing that we have now?
We will be able to hold on to the same thing now, because yeast isn't, it's not going to mutate, it's not going to change unless we force that change upon it. And on the lab level, you know, we're not subjugating these strains to any sort of environmental stress, so we're giving it no reason to evolve or mutate. mutate. But you can do that in short order in your brewery, and sometimes that works out to your benefit. And I'm gonna reference Pac-Man to this. I mean, we think Pac-Man was at one point in time Cal Ale 01 or 1056, but just through the time and the environmental conditions that John and the guys at Rode, you know, forced upon that yeast, caused it to change to do what they want, and so it can happen. But in terms of a commercial producer, we don't want to do that. You know, we want to make sure that what we're putting out onto the marketplace, you know, is what we sent out last year, which is what we sent out 5 years ago, 10 years ago. And fortunately, we've been in business for a little over 20 years now. Dave Logsdon, our owner, founder, he's got a great palate. He's got a lot of experience with, you know, all these yeasts. He tastes, you know, beers produced from them constantly. So, you know, if something weird did pop up, you know, sensory-wise, we'd be able to determine it. But hopefully we're going to catch it before that, you know, in the lab when it comes to analyzing the plates and looking at the morphology. And that pink yeast is a good example of that. Now that I'm starting to think about it, I think it was the 1026, that cask ale yeast that we put out on the last it was the English ale, the cask ale PC offering in fall, because we brought a new culture of that in from a yeast bank. So we're not selling you pink yeast.
How did it taste?
I'm sorry?
How did it taste?
The pink stuff?
Yeah.
I didn't have any, so I can't answer that question. But I'd be curious. Maybe it was awesome. You know? Really? Who cares if it looks different, you know? Brew up a batch and see what it does, you know? It could be great. So at the very least, they kept it in the bank.
Yeah.
And, you know, And I wish we had more time to kind of like play around and do that kind of stuff, but we are freaking slammed right now. I mean, we are with the recession and all this crap that's going on. It's been really busy at the lab. As I was telling Mark and the guys at dinner and beers, that we're moving between 8 and 10,000. Retail units, activators or propagators per week, and then that's 50% of our business. The other 50% is the commercial guys, the craft guys. So we are really, really busy. You know, I wish we had more time to do more research and more test ferments. Unfortunately, we just don't.
So your business is up when the economy is down. Is that what you're saying?
We are way up right now. So yeah, great problem to have. So sir.
What do you do with the byproduct of your yeast production?
Beer. Basically, the beer we make goes down the drain, and it's not beer. You know, we're using an extract product that we load up with a nutrient to do our propagation, and then that beer that is produced is it's applied as an agricultural amendment. And right now we've kind of reached the point to where, you know, all the little bro deals that we've set up to like dump this stuff on people's fields, now we've reached the critical mass, and now we've kind of got to take a next step. And one of the guys in the lab, that's one of his jobs, is to get this licensed and marketed as an agriculture amendment. And we got a big like organic community in our neck of the woods, so we're looking at, you know, composting and you know, the vineyard, the orchards that are up there, they'll take this stuff. But it goes on the ground. So, sir.
So you mentioned temperature control earlier, yeah. And I was wondering, so how crucial is it? I mean, I've read people who swear by plus or minus 1 degree, and then I've never really paid that much attention. It's in the range, it's okay. So, you know, what effect does, you know, the range of temperatures have? And also, along with that, is I've also read that the ester profile is mostly set within the first 24 hours, so that's the most important point for temperature control. So could you talk about that?
Okay, temperature control during your lag phase, or where the bulk of fermentation occurs, and that's where the majority of those esters are produced. I think the biggest thing that, aside from ester formation, that can occur from a lack of temperature control is fusels or higher alcohols. A lot of yeast will produce these alcohol components at an elevated temperature. If I want to take a shot of beer, and if I feel that alcoholic burn, my taste, what I care about, I don't want it. You know, if I want to feel that, I'm going to go have a shot of gin. You know, I don't want to feel that alcoholic burn, even on a high alcohol beer, you know, 10, 12%. And so temp control can result in those characteristics. Now, if you're producing a Belgian that has that alcoholic note, or if you want, personally, you want to feel that... that perception of a higher alcohol, then go ahead and let your temp ramp up. But it's also going to be strain specific. Take a Saison strain like our 3724 or White Labs Bastogne, and unless you're pushing that up into the 80s, that fermentation is going to stick on you at about 10:30 or so. And it'll take another 2 to 3 weeks to finish out. And those strains, for whatever, you know, it's strain specific, won't produce those higher alcohols. So you can ramp that that temp way up there with no ill effect. So ultimately, it depends on what kind of beer are you making and what are you looking for in the final product. So, sir.
Is there any way of knowing what higher alcohols are being produced, or any way of testing?
Aside from, and I'm sure there are, but aside from sensory, I don't know. I'm sure that there are lab tests that you can run that can determine, is it a GC, chromatograph, or some other lab test, but ultimately, I think all we really care about is how does that beer taste. You know, what is its finish? I mean, if you're making a pale ale with 1056 that you're fermenting at 85 degrees, it tastes great to you. Don't change a thing. You know, just stick with it. So, okay. So we're back to stationary phase here. So the yeast is kind of crapping out. The bulk of your fermentation is done. It's building its reserves. It's at this point where you might want to consider a diacetyl rest if it's necessary. And again, depending on the strain and the fermentation conditions that you impose upon that will dictate whether you like diacetyl in your beer or not, will dictate whether you want it to run it through a diacetyl rest. It's in this stationary phase that needs to occur, and it's at this point where yeast will start to flock up and settle out. You know.
Could you go over that a little bit? What are the proper ramp up and ramp down times so that you don't basically just make everything flock right out?
Okay. Now, when it comes to diacetyl?
Yeah, diacetyl rest.
Great. So a diacetyl rest, again, it's all contingent upon what you want to see in your final product. Some beers may call for a slight amount of diacetyl. Your personal tastes might dictate that you want a little bit of that diacetyl in your beer. And it's an easy test to do. It's either a go or a no-go, where you can take a sample of your beer 24 to 48 hours after you've hit your final gravity, and you warm that up to 110 degrees or so. You can put that on top of your hot liquor tank, hot water heater, or put it in the microwave for 30 seconds or a minute, however strong it is, whatever. All you're trying to do is warm a sample up. Do your swirl and try to contain the aromatics in there and take a sniff. And if you're picking up movie popcorn butter, and it's beyond what you desire, then take your fermentation, and you need to warm it up somewhere around 5 degrees Fahrenheit for a period of 12 to 24 to 36 to however long it takes for that stuff to dissipate. It will dissipate with an elevated temperature. It's a high volatile. It'll come up out of solution. So at the end of whatever your diacetyl rest is, again, go back to pulling a sample, warm it up, take a sniff, and if it's gone, then you're okay to crash. So
when you say crash, how fast is crash?
Crash
what
it.
What gravity should you be at when you're doing this diacetyl rest?
You should be at final attenuation. So you should have a static gravity reading for a period of 2 days or more, and then when you crash, I mean, it doesn't matter if you bring your temperature down slowly or if you turn it all the way down to 32, it's not going to make your beer flock out really any better or worse than not. I've always both commercially and the homebrew batches that I've done, is I get it down as close to 32 degrees as I possibly can right now. So
like basically after the diacetyl rest, you pretty much just want the yeast out of there.
Yep. So turn the temp down, try to get it out. Some yeast isn't gonna flock out. It depends on the strain. Some of it's gonna drop like a rock. Some of it might want to flock out before it's done. The 1968. Is a good example of that. They call it this cheese yeast. We can visibly see it in the fermenter. It's this big, chunky, globby mess, you know, and it wants to drop like a rock. So, and those beers, you know, you have to kind of rouse, get that yeast back up in suspension to kind of force it to finish out. So, sir.
I was just wondering if that rapid temperature change had any effect on the future viability of the yeast.
Unless you freeze it.
Yeah.
So and even then, if it goes through like a light freeze, you know, you probably get some viable yeast out of it. But if it goes into a deep freeze, it's not the freeze itself, it's the thaw that causes the cell wall to rupture. Then you've got dead yeast. That's why if you're going to freeze yeast, you've got to use the glycerin, and that'll help keep that cell wall intact. So. So what is all this lag laws or log lag, stationary phase, what does it give us? Well, it gives us beer in the final product. So controlling that rate of fermentation, the extent and the rate of growth is how we can repeatably make a consistent process. So how do we go about controlling the environmental conditions and the consistency of wort and the strain selection and the pitch rate, and I want to get into a strain selection here for a minute.
Wait, Brian, do you want to take a quick like 5 minute break or 10 minute break?
Sure.
Okay.
Potty break?
You just spoke a mouthful right there.
Right on.
So yeah, let's take a quick break, and you want to fill up your beers, and then we'll start cutting it too.
Good call.
Good. See you guys.
How's it going?
All right. You going to be down in Oakland?